Welcome to the President's Inbox, a CFR podcast about the foreign policy challenges facing the United States. I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. This week's topic is the Middle East. Today's episode is part of the special Transition 2021 series on the President's Inbox. In the weeks running up to Inauguration Day, I'm sitting down with experts to discuss the foreign policy challenges facing the incoming Biden administration. With me to discuss how President-elect Joe Biden will likely handle U.S. policy toward the Middle East are Stephen Cook and Martin Indyk. Stephen is the ENI Enrico Mattei Senior Fellow for Middle East and Africa Studies and Director of the International Affairs Fellowship for Tenured International Relations Scholars at the Council. He is an expert on Arab and Turkish politics, as well as U.S. Middle East policy. Stephen's most recent book is False Dawn: Protest, Democracy, and Violence in the New Middle East. Martin is a distinguished fellow at the Council. He served twice as U.S. ambassador to Israel, first from 1995 to 1997, and then again from 2000 to 2001. Martin was also the U.S. special envoy for the Israeli-Palestinian negotiations from July 2013 to June 2014. He is the author of the forthcoming book, Master of the Game, Henry Kissinger and the Art of the Middle East Deal. Stephen and Martin, we're very excited to have you here today, especially as we've had to battle some technological issues to get this recording down. My apologies to the audience if some still remain.
It's a great pleasure to be with you, Jim.
Thanks, Jim.
I want to talk about how a President Biden will likely approach the Middle East. But before I do, I want to begin with your assessments of how President Trump handled relations in the region. And if I may, can I start with you, Martin?
Well, I have labeled him the accidental peacemaker, because on that issue, he sought to present the deal of the century to the Israelis and the Palestinians, but he couldn't make a sale with the Palestinians. But in the process of selling it to the Israelis, he supported their annexation of 40% of the West Bank, including all of the settlements. And that had the accidental, unintended consequence of having the Crown Prince of the United Arab Emirates knock on the door and offer a deal in which there would be no annexation. Annexation would be taken off the table in exchange for normalization of relations between Israel and the United Arab Emirates. And that was not really a peace deal, it's a normalization deal, but that was an important breakthrough that Trump achieved. Now he's gone on to do deals to get Sudan and Bahrain and Morocco also to normalize. And there the costs involved are, I think, questionable. We should perhaps discuss that. More broadly, I think that Trump's policy in the Middle East has been notable for two things. One, a continuation of Obama's policy of retrenchment, of pulling troops out of the Middle East. But instead of doing it in a coherent way, he's done it in a kind of spasmodic way, which has been quite disruptive, particularly in Syria. And the second thing he's been notable for is a kind of scattershot strategy that doesn't have real strategy behind it, but just impulses. So he has a maximum pressure campaign against Iran, where he's piled on sanctions and pulled out of the nuclear deal with Iran. But that has just led, instead of forcing Iran to the table as he thought it would, it has led the Iranians to dig in their heels and leave the nuclear deal themselves. And so they're now marching towards acquiring nuclear weapons capability, unconstrained by the nuclear deal that had been put in place by Trump's predecessor.
Stephen, let me get your assessment of the Trump administration's policy toward the Middle East. Do you agree with Martin, or do you take issue with some of his points?
You know, Trump's approach from the very beginning up until these waning days in office, he has talked about withdrawing troops from the region, but he has also done things that invite more troops in the region. He Qasem Soleimani, the leader of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, which resulted in retaliation by the Iranians, but also required the addition of troops to the region. After failing to respond to Iranian provocations in the Gulf during the summer of 2019, the president had to flow more troops into the region after the Iranians took out two major oil processing facilities in Saudi Arabia. What is it? Did the president want to withdraw and retrench, as Martin, to continue at a large American presence in the region? Just take his broader policy with regard to Iran, maximum pressure, which is a self-fulfilling type of thing. When it doesn't work, the only answer to it is more pressure, which then results in Iranian adventurism around the region that puts the United States and its allies on the defensive. When it comes to peace, of course, I defer to Martin's expertise on this, but he claimed that he was going to do the deal of the century. And what he essentially offered was a deal that allowed the Israelis to annex territory. What peace deals have come about, particularly the Abraham Accords, are things that really were at the behest of the Emiratis as well as the Israelis. And the United States was expected to seal the deal with copious amounts of weapons as a result. When it comes to the new Morocco deal, it means a major change in American foreign policy for no apparent benefit.
Stephen, can I just stop you right there? Could I get you to explain the Morocco deal?
Yeah. Essentially, President Trump agreed to alter longstanding U.S. policy on the Western Sahara region and recognize Moroccan sovereignty over that region. That is a part of North Africa that has been fought over for many years. Believe that they should have an independent state there and have rejected Morocco's offers of autonomy. So what President Trump has done is offered the King of Morocco a change in American policy to recognize Moroccan sovereignty there in exchange for normalizing relations with Israel. This is hardly in the kind of spirit of peace, especially since, you know, Morocco and Israel have a fairly robust ties under the table. So it comes at a risk of destabilizing North Africa for the gains seem to be only accrued to President Trump's ability to say that he was able to engineer a deal unlike his predecessors.
I think I hear both of you saying that for America's traditional friends in the region, I'm thinking Israel, thinking Saudi Arabia, thinking the United Arab Emirates, they're pretty happy or have been pretty happy with President Trump's approach to the region. So I want to ask a question about those allies. How do they view the advent of a Biden administration? Are they viewing it as a positive turn of events, or are they concerned about what a President Biden might do? Martin, maybe I can get you to start off.
I think they're deeply concerned. When they look at Joe Biden, they see him not as the incoming president, but as Barack Obama's vice president. And they had a real problem with Obama's policy, in particular towards Iran, but also they remember his policy towards the Arab Spring and the way in which they feel he pulled the rug out from President Mubarak of Egypt, which the spring there, revolution there, created Mubarak's overthrow, which was deeply concerning to all of the Arab Gulf leaders who are autocrats themselves. They are aware that Biden wants to go back to the nuclear deal with Iran that they found highly problematic, essentially because it didn't deal with all of the other activities of Iran in the region that were destabilizing and threatening to them. The Israelis have a similar concern about Iran. Netanyahu has already said publicly twice during this transition period in Washington that he is opposed to the United States going back to the nuclear deal, conjuring up memories of the way in which he went before a joint session of Congress to try to stop the Iran nuclear deal that President Obama negotiated. I think that there's a real concern on the part of both the Israeli leadership and the Gulf Arab leadership, and I would add President Sisi of Egypt into that mix, that what they're going to see is a return to policies that were deeply problematic to them. And I should add one other dimension to this, which they're concerned about, which is that Joe Biden has made clear that he's going to reintroduce values into American foreign policy. They understand that to mean human rights. Their records on human rights, particularly when it comes to the Saudi Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, but also President Sisi of Egypt, highly problematic. And Biden has already made that clear in the case of Saudi Arabia. And so I think they're bothered about that as well.
Stephen, could I get your sense of the temperature in the region as capitals look out at Washington and see a transition taking place, particularly, I would imagine, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, but also one of your favorite countries, Egypt?
I think that there is just considerable consternation among the countries that Martin talked about. The candidate, now President-elect Joe Biden, called the Saudi leadership beyond the pale during a Democratic debate. Now, one can chalk that up to campaign rhetoric, but at the same time, it's clear that the U.S.-Saudi relationship is going to be relitigated in Washington, D.C. It strikes me that there are a variety of issues in addition to human rights. Saudi Arabia's intervention in Yemen, arms sales to Saudi Arabia, lingering distrust over the attacks on New York and Washington in 2001, the jailing of activists, even if they have a small constituency in Saudi Arabia. These are all things that, and of course, I should mention the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, which was actually an event that really kind of turned much of Washington's eyes towards things like the destruction of Yemen. So I think that the Saudis in particular are going to have a difficult time in the early going with the Biden administration. At the very least, if President Biden speaks out about human rights abuses, if he talks about female activists in Saudi jails, that is going to be hugely different from what the Trump administration has done. When it comes to Egypt, you know, Abdel Fattah Sisi has presided over the most profoundly repressive period in Egyptian history, and I'm including Gamal Abdel Nasser's reign. There is going to be a debate about Egypt's importance to the United States, whether it remains as important as it once was. And pivoting off of that question of whether Egypt is as important as it once was, is does the United States still have a responsibility? Does it still need to provide $1.3 billion in foreign military assistance on an annual basis? I suspect those are going to be significant issues. The difference, though, between the upcoming Biden period and the Obama period is the Egyptians at least feel that they do have somewhat something in terms of an alternative. The last time I was in the Egyptian defense ministry, just before the pandemic, I was told the United States really should not demand that Egypt choose between China and the United States because it's not going to make that choice. I have photos from a previous trip of a Russian military aircraft on the flight line at Cairo International Airport. That's something different. The Egyptians have bought more military equipment from the Russians in the last few years than they have since the early 1970s. So they clearly believe, whether this is something that is true or not, whether they clearly believe that they will have to pay less and less attention to admonitions from Washington about the human rights record or not, they clearly think that they have something in the way of alternatives.
Martin, I want to talk about the president-elect. But before we get into the particulars of whether he's going to move the embassy back from Jerusalem or enter the Iran nuclear deal or what his specific policy is going to be on human rights, I'd like you to sort of sketch out from your perspective how you think Joe Biden views the Middle East. I mean, the president-elect is someone who's been active in foreign policy for a very long time. He has a track record as a senator. And is there some sort of takeaway? Is he somebody who's interested in the Middle East, wants to get out of the Middle East, views certain countries more important than the others? What sort of his general sort of worldview when it comes to the Middle East?
Well, Joe Biden's been around American foreign policy for a very long time. Just going back in writing my book about Henry Kissinger's diplomacy in the Middle East, he had to sell to the Congress the idea of putting 200 American technicians into the Sinai as part of the peace deal that he negotiated. And there were only two senators that opposed it back in 1975. One was the leader of the Senate, Senator Mike Mansfield. The other was a freshman senator named Joe Biden. And it's interesting because he has a history of opposing interventions, military interventions and extended military interventions. And his retrenchment that we've been talking about started with Obama, and that was sort of haphazardly by President Trump. So I think that he approaches the region with a degree of skepticism, a bit of a jaundiced eye, knows all the players very well. He's been around there for a long time. And I think that he is very much aware that America's priorities need to be elsewhere in the Middle East. And then, so I think he's a strong advocate of focusing on China and climate change and these other issues. He was, as vice president, involved as a kind of observer of all of the shenanigans involved in the Israeli-Palestinian peace process. And he kept his own counsel during the meetings that I was in with him. But he certainly saw just how impossible it was to move Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Mahmoud Abbas of the Palestinian Authority. So I don't believe that he's going to be listening to the siren song of Middle East peacemaking. He's every indication is that he's going to downplay that because of this kind of skepticism that he has about what can be done. He knows that you can't ignore the Middle East, but I think he's going to be far more focused on trying to fix the nuclear deal with Iran and just trying to contain the problems elsewhere.
Stephen, when you look at the president-elect, do you see him as having a top priority or two in the Middle East, or is it mostly about just trying to limit the amount of time he has to spend on Middle Eastern issues so he can focus on China or domestic problems at home?
Thanks, Jim. It's a good question. And let me answer it sort of in the reverse in which you asked it. I've had any number of conversations with journalists and others, different groups, since the president-elect was elected and asked me this question. And I answered every time with a caveat, just that President-elect Biden is going to come to office with a huge domestic agenda. Even though there's good vaccine news, COVID, related problem of the economy, racial justice issues, political polarization in the country. These are things, this was particularly the latter was sort of the underlying theory for his run for office. And I expect that he'll focus on that. And then when it comes to foreign policy, I think the big issues are repairing U.S. relations with its traditional allies in Europe, obviously China, and then big global issues like climate change and obviously infectious disease. When it does come to the Middle East, it strikes me that there's going to be two things that are going to occupy President Biden's time. First is, as Martin pointed out, fixing the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, either reopening that to negotiation to the extent that the Iranians are willing to include other things into the agreement or negotiating an entirely new agreement. I should say that that issue is also connected to repairing America's relations with its allies in Europe, because, of course, they are party to this agreement as well. So it seems to me everything that we've seen, everything that he has said, everything that his now appointed advisors say point in that direction. The second thing is, and we talked about it a bit before, is what to do about our traditional partners in the region, particularly what to do about Saudi Arabia. Again, he was outspoken during the campaign. The Secretary of State, Tony Blinken, has spoken out about Saudi behavior. And there's going to be, I think, a lot of pressure from the Congress as well. There is a lot of unhappiness with Saudi Arabia in the discussion about Saudi Arabia in the Congress. So those issues, and I think the Saudi issue is wrapped up into broader issues concerning human rights and democracy, although I don't see those as really fruitful avenues for the president to pursue. Even at the most advantageous moment when Arab leaders were being overthrown about a decade ago, the United States was unable at crucial moments to move the needle when it came to human rights and democracy, because it's not really about us. It's about what's going on in the region. But I suspect that the administration will, at least at a rhetorical level, speak about those issues.
So, Martin, how is the president-elect going to square the circle that you have set out for him? If I understand you correctly, what you're suggesting is that his number one priority is trying to manage the Iran problem, while at the same time trying to maintain reasonable relations with Israel and other countries in the region. But obviously, as you pointed out, the Israelis have signaled they are deeply opposed to the United States re-entering the Iran nuclear deal. I imagine the Saudis and the Emiratis feel the same way. While I take the point that President Biden probably is not going to make Middle East peace a top priority, he's not going to fall prey, as you put it, to the siren song of Middle East peace. He obviously has to pay attention to that as well. How does he make all of this work?
With difficulty, there is a tension, most definitely, as you point out. And it's compounded by the fact that he essentially wants to focus elsewhere, has other priorities, as we've discussed. And therefore, he has to look to some body or alliance of partners in the region to take on more of the burden of stabilizing an area that is still of concern to the United States, if not vital interest, nevertheless, considerable importance. And how is he going to square that tension? How is he going to depend on Israel, the United Arab Emirates, and Saudi Arabia, a kind of Israeli-Sunni Arab alliance, as the way of the pillars of an American-supported order in the region, if he's going to be at loggerheads with them, either over human rights issues or the nuclear Iran file? So it's not going to be an easy tiptoe through the raindrops here. And that doesn't take account of all of the unexpected things that could well happen. But having said all of that, I do think that he has a way forward. And let me try to put it succinctly. First of all, he needs to put the relationship with Saudi Arabia on a more solid basis. He needs to have a kind of come to Jesus type conversation, mixed by metaphors, with the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia.
He bought that Jesus portrait, so it's okay.
Yes, that's true. Okay, so I think that the Crown Prince is interested in that. He started to do some things that suggest that he knows that he's going to have to up his game in a more positive way. And one of the things I think he's going to do is offer Biden to normalize Saudi Arabia's relations with Israel. And that is, in a way, kind of low-hanging fruit that can create a positive environment, not just between Israel and the Sunni Arabs and reinforce this alliance that I was talking about, but also provide a way to move forward on the Palestinian front as well, because the Saudis are going to want some Palestinian cover. And so I think that President Biden will be able to use that to lubricate some concessions from Israel towards the Palestinians that will kind of calm things down there. But on the issue of human rights, as Steve suggests, it's going to be very complicated and difficult for him to get them to accept the kinds of changes in their internal behavior that they're going to be very reluctant to do. And on the nuclear file, you know, Netanyahu has a very high bar that he's going to want Biden to jump over. And I don't think that Biden is interested in really jumping in the way that Donald Trump was prepared to do.
Stephen, I want to ask you about some other issues in the region that a President Biden might deal with or might have to deal with, and that is conflicts in the region. Obviously, conflict in Yemen, conflict in Libya, we have conflict in Syria, and a country we haven't talked about, but not too long ago dominated every discussion about the Middle East, and that is Iraq. Where do you see a Biden presidency going in dealing with those issues?
It's going to be very tough, and particularly when it comes to Iraq, because the Iraqis view President-elect Biden as someone who has been far from constructive. First, he, as a senator, penned an op-ed with the late former president of the Council on Foreign Relations, Les Gelb, that was interpreted in Iraq as advocating the breakup of the country into three separate countries. It was really an argument about a kind of hyper-republicanism that would hold the country together, but nevertheless, it was interpreted that way. And he also was the Obama administration's point man on Iraq during some of the worst aspects of Maliki's reign in Iraq. So the problem, though, is that there's not much for the United States to do in Iraq other than continue the security mission and help the Iraqis continue to confront the Islamic State or whatever comes next, as well as bolster Iraq's sovereignty, which is part of containing Iran. But President Trump has not left President-elect Biden with much to work with there. The American forces in Iraq are now down to about 2,500 people. And then add to it some members of NATO who have kept troops there. It's not a lot, but it at the very least continue the security mission that will continue to try to contain the Islamic State. But Iraq really is in terminal collapse. There are huge protests in the Kurdish region right now. There was lots of hopes for Prime Minister Mustafa al-Qadhimi. Has not worked out. Iran is intent on continuing its vassalization of Iraq. And we don't have the resources there, nor do we have the political will to turn the tide. When it comes to Yemen, it's an extremely difficult situation for the United States. Everybody agrees, including the Saudis, that they need to get out of Yemen. But the Houthis have them pinned down, bleeding and weakening. And there's not much that anybody can offer. There's nothing that the Saudis, it seems, can offer the Houthis, where the Houthis will say, okay, we won, and we'll let the Saudis out of the trap that we have laid for them. It's going to take a significant amount of political and diplomatic creativity for that to happen. And the Houthis are very, very tough customers. It's going to mean working with the Omanis. It's going to mean also, you know, working with the Iranians, which is going to be controversial here in Washington, if this comes at the same time we're trying to reopen negotiation over the nuclear file. Syria is something that I think we need to get to the point where we think about Syria in an entirely different way than we've thought about it previously. I think the Turks are intent on maintaining their sphere of influence there to prevent the Kurds from establishing a state. And I think the civil war will grind on throughout at least a first Biden administration. The war just keeps entering new phases and new phases. One thing that I think people should be aware of is that Bashar Assad is actually on the ropes. His economy was tied to the Lebanese economy. The Lebanese economy has crashed. It has undermined the ability of Bashar al-Assad to pay off the people around him. Now, the question is, if Assad falls, is that going to provide an opportunity for peace and reconciliation? I suspect not. I suspect it will be a new phase of a civil war. How the United States can affect events there, I think, remains unclear. And if it happens, will be hotly contested. And then finally, Libya. Actually, there's been some progress in Libya. The UN has gotten all the Libyan factions to sit down and negotiate. But one of the main external actors in Libya, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, has said, well, there is a ceasefire, but I will ceasefire. So when the president-elect enters the Oval Office and is going to look at the region, he's going to look at a region that is in far worse shape than when he moved out of his West Wing office 4 years ago.
So the state of play in the Middle East then, Stephen, could be summed up as a hot mess.
Maybe you want to call it a hot mess. I called it in an article early in the fall called The End of Hope. It does seem that President Biden, to the extent that he has time to focus on the Middle East, is going to be contending with the ongoing conflicts and all kinds of political problems where it's hard to see where he can score a win.
Martin, I want to bring the conversation back home to the United States. Obviously, we're going to be sending envoys and diplomats around the Middle East to talk to people, try to, in essence, bring tensions down, minimize conflict. But I would imagine that the Biden administration is also going to have to be spending a lot of time sending people up to Capitol Hill. Because as I look at it, there seems to be growing divisions on Capitol Hill about what U.S. policy should be in the region. You have those who want to get out, those who want to stay in, those who think we aren't supportive enough of Israel, those who think we're too supportive of Israel. We have people who think we should be backing the Saudis, others who think that we should be really leaning on the Saudis in terms of their human rights policy. You alluded to that before. So can you just give us some sense of the lay of the land domestically and how a Biden administration navigates that? Because I know you have some real world experience on these issues, and probably one or two scars to go along with it.
Indeed. There was an interesting vote this week in the Senate on a resolution of disapproval of the proposed UAE arms sale of F-35s to UAE. That was part of the package of normalization between Israel and the UAE. That is to say that the Trump administration would sell the F-35s to the UAE and that Israel would support the sale, because Israel has considerable support on the Hill. It was considered that with Israel's support, which was manifest in clear public statements, that the sale would go through very easily. It didn't. I mean, it went through, but all of the Democrats, 49 of them, voted against the sale, even though Israel was in favor of it and not concerned about it. And their normal reason why they would vote against it was because of concern for Israel's security. So that tells you something about the way in which even Israel has become a partisan issue on the Hill in one way or another. But it's certainly true of arms sales to Gulf Arabs. The UAE deal was done this way because the UAE wanted to separate itself from Saudi Arabia, where there's real bipartisan opposition to arms sales to Saudi Arabia. And when it comes to Israel, the progressive wing of the Democratic Party that is influential on the Hill and indeed has some influence with President Biden is very concerned about the Palestinian issue, even as the president doesn't really want to pay a lot of attention to that. But if the Israelis go ahead with settlement activity, as they're kind of bound to do, that too is going to become a contentious issue on the Hill. So not only has the president-elect a whole basket of troubles in the region, but concerning support domestically is going to be difficult as well. And I should have added, there's a great deal of division over the nuclear deal as well, with the Republicans strongly opposed to it and the Democrats supporting what President-elect Biden wants to do.
I suspect that in Abu Dhabi, Riyadh, Jerusalem, as well as Cairo, they are looking towards the runoff in Georgia, hoping that the two Republican candidates win.
I want to close our conversation by asking both of you to look forward, to imagine yourselves a year from now. How are we likely to be describing the Biden administration's foreign policy? Will we be talking about a significant withdrawal from the region? Will we be talking about a significant increase in U.S. presence there? Something else? Maybe, Steve, we can begin with you.
Oh, God, these prediction questions are always so hard to handle. I remember about a decade ago, people were saying that Hosni Mubarak his rule was stable and that the only change that would come is if he died and either his son or his intelligence chief became the next president of Egypt. Of course, neither of those things happened and Hosni Mubarak fell. But I know what I would like to see out of a Biden administration. I'd like to see that President Biden actually hold off the progressive wing of the party and hold off those who want to withdraw from the region and that we stay there, but we stay there with a very specific set of priorities, containing the exercise of Iranian power, continuing to fight extremism through the security mission in Iraq, and not withdrawing in a way that creates chaos. Just our presence there, it can be reconfigured, but our presence, the idea that we would be leaving, leads to more chaos and more bloodshed, and in fact, provides opportunity for competitors like the Russians and the Chinese. So I'd like for us to stay. And I think that, you know, from what I know, of course, it strikes me that President-elect Biden is one who would want to pursue a pragmatic policy in the region that is neither the kind of revolutionary in its own way approach of George W. Bush and revolutionary in its own way of the man that he served, President Obama. I don't think now is the time for bold moves in the region.
Martin, how about you? Where do you see things likely to be a year from now?
Well, in the Middle East, it's very dangerous to try to predict what's going to happen a month from now, let alone a year from now. for President Biden that perhaps we haven't focused enough on in this discussion. One is the normalization process that he inherits from President Trump. Because as I suggested, I think that there's a way to develop that can help to build this Israeli-Sunni-Arab partnership with American support, but also do that in a way that will benefit the effort to move the Israeli-Palestinian relationship in a positive direction. And then on the other side, I do think that there's one advantage of the maximum pressure campaign that President Trump imposed on Iraq, all of those sanctions, give President Biden considerable leverage when it comes to his objective of negotiating a stronger and longer nuclear deal with Iran, as he has said as his objective, because the Iranians are hurting very badly. And those sanctions have been used as sticks. They can be turned into carrots, applied judiciously in exchange for, first of all, Iran coming back into compliance with its obligations under the Iran nuclear deal, and then entering into serious negotiations to make the deal better. And so I think that there is a positive agenda that is available to the president, and I think he will pursue it. And that may get us into a better place a year from now.
Well, on that more positive, optimistic note, I am going to close up the President's Inbox for this week. My guests have been Stephen Cook, he and I, Enrico Mattei, Senior Fellow for Middle East and Africa Studies here at the Council, and Martin Indyk, the Council's Distinguished Fellow and a former U.S. Ambassador to Israel. Stephen, Martin, thank you for joining me.
Many thanks, Jim.
Thank you.
Please subscribe to the President's Inbox on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you listen, and leave us a review. They help us get noticed and improve the show. As always, opinions expressed on the President's Inbox are solely those of the host or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's episode was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlich. Zoe did double duty as our recording engineer. Thank you, Zoe. Special thanks go out to Margaret Gatch for her assistance. This is Jim Lindsay. Thanks for listening.